Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Saturn Box Podcast, where discussions of philosophy meet the liminal space we weave in dreams. This is your favorite neurodivergent witch and proponent of paradoxical thinking, Mikala Ann. This week, I have guest Tamarin, musician, witch, perpetual student of the cosmos, and owner of the store Major Arcana, in Half Moon Bay, California. This episode is a powerful expression of creativity, passion, and shadow work. As Saturnine witches, we tackle these subjects as they must be truly seen, beyond masks of virtue, and bound instead by an intentional acknowledgement of the all-being as paradoxical in nature. This is all discussed through a thelemic, psychoanalytical, and astrological lens. From Yaquis Lacan to Kenneth Grant, from Nico symbiotically consuming Mark Almond's soul and song, to the groundbreaking work of Amodali. Above all, with a particular reverence for all the publicly unknown priestesses and magicians on their own personal esoteric path towards embodiment of those currents that collectively act as the rising tide of a new aeon. What does it mean to follow one's true will? How might we consume our demons to integrate shadow and flesh? How might we best become channels of communication between heaven and earth? All this and more in today's episode of Saturn Box. If you find this podcast interesting and want to show some support, consider checking out the Patreon at www.patreon.com/Saturnbox. This week, we will be having a personalized playlist made by Tamarin herself, along with a song-by-song discussion of why each was chosen for the mix. This playlist is a musical accompaniment to Tamarin's message, and any of you who are interested in the combination of music and ritual should head over to the Patreon and check it out.
Hello. Should we talk about what just happened or no?
Yeah. Which of the things that just happened, though?
Okay. So, God had a wife, right? It's just really funny. You said you got your period the second I tried to join the room to record the podcast.
Let the sacrifice begin is what you told me.
Yeah, well, you know, I've definitely had those moments on stage before too, where you walk out on stage and it's just like the ritual has begun, I guess.
Do you feel like more creatively fluid? There's some sort of cathartic release in that moment where you walk on stage and your period is happening and you're just like, let's fucking go. Just to get as messy and as cathartically emotional as I can manage in this moment.
Yes, definitely. That's definitely the vibe. It's sometimes just meant to be like that. The other thing that is really weird is that right before we got on the phone, I pulled the card to kind of see like what archetype maybe to focus on, because I know we have so many things we could discuss. We've known each other for a while now and we have so many shared interests. And I got the Eon card and I was like, okay, all right. And then I realized that today is the 14th of April, right? And the notable thing about that is that that was the day that the atom bomb was split.
Interesting that that is the card that you pulled, the Aeon card, atom bomb moment.
Right? It's like the Aeon of Horus, right? Like Horus is the Pluto character kind of in that card. And I believe that card is Shin, right?
Yes, it would be Shin. So it's kind of like that consuming fire, like it's a mouth, right? Actually, weird, really similar to this idea of the atom bomb. The base of the Shin is the place that we're all connected, like the singular atom. And then when it's split into multiplicity, it creates this like chaos and potentially violence and basically just this churning of birth, right? Because it's a mouth, but it eats and then it shits out creation, basically.
Exactly. Same.
Same.
Yeah, and I think that card is just, there's so much to unpack there that I think aligns with kind of everything I want to sort of talk about today, or like that I think we're probably going to talk about today. So I just thought that was a nice starter, and it being the date of the atom bomb was trippy because I actually pulled up the chart. I was looking at it and pull it up again. So it was Uranus in Gemini and the atom bombs were twins.
Oh.
Yeah. This is when it hit Hiroshima. The top aspect that day was Sun, sextile Mars. Anyways, so Uranus and Gemini, I just thought it was interesting because there were two bombs. They were twins. And one of them was called Little Boy, which is so Horus. I don't know. We haven't really ever talked about the like Thelemic Aeon formula thing or what your views on that are really. And I actually haven't even introduced myself or anything.
Yeah, 5 minutes in. Hey, everybody, this is Tamarin.
Yes. Okay, cool. And what else? Do I need to say anything else before we get into our esoteric ramblings?
I always let my guests introduce themselves. You've listened to the podcast.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, I was born in New Zealand, but I moved to the States around 7 years old and grew up mostly in the Pacific Northwest in California. I do get called a New Zealand artist quite often because that's just, people kind of just default to the first information they see. And I feel like that's disrespectful to New Zealand because, you know, I actually do want to retire there and end up there, but I don't live there and I didn't really live there much of my life. But my years there were incredibly formative and magical. And I think that it's interesting in my astrocartography. My Jupiter line runs right Fern, and it doesn't go through any other areas I've ever lived. So I think it is an important place to me for sure.
Interesting. So there's like abundance waiting for you whenever you're ready to return.
I feel that. I definitely feel that. And I mean, the country itself is just a very special place. It's so beautiful and they really take care of their people there. You know, I could probably retire as an artist and live a beautiful life, essentially. So that's kind of my dream in that way. But I actually left New Zealand as a child because the group that I was born into, sort of a, as we talked about a little bit, sort of a magical group. And it's cool now that, you know, we're in this whole new wave where, like, you know, you hear a lot of people complaining about how magic's a trend or when is it going to go away, whatever. But I don't think it's going away. I think it's a shift. And when I was a kid raised by people that identified as witches or, you know, mystics or Jungian freaks or whatever, we were outcasts. We were literally exiled from New Zealand. And when we got to this country, they were not treated much better, you know?
So then they relocate to New Orleans, similarly to like how the Process Church came to New Orleans?
Well, I wouldn't compare the two, but I think one of the reasons why we kind of made, or I mean, I was so young, I really wasn't part of like any ethos or whatever, I was just a child, but the people I was raised with there, I think the reason why people were afraid of them was because historically New Zealand was a place that you'd go to start a cult, you know what I mean? And then, you know, where'd we go after we left there? We went to the Pacific Northwest, to Washington. We actually lived in the town that they were filming Twin Peaks in at the time then.
Oh, wow.
I know. And then after that, yeah, Vegas and then New Orleans, all just kind of like, I guess what people might refer to as vortexes or ley lines or, you know, energetic.
Yes. It's like sometimes I'm really particular about not wanting to use New Age vocabulary, but it was my first thought when you were naming these locations was, oh, vortex places. You're just like missing Sedona on that list.
Well, my mom, you know, my mom wrote a book about being Nefertiti in a past life. And in the book, she goes to Sedona in the 70s and does like a peyote trip and has a past life regression. And that's when she downloads all the information of, you know, the dark feminine that was complicit during the birth of monotheism and all the stuff that you love to talk about. But anyways, New Zealand, Washington, yes, then New Orleans. That's what you were asking about. And then New Orleans is basically where my godmother, who was my mentor and kind of, I guess, the person in the group that people looked up to is how I would put it. She passed away in New Orleans. So that was the end of that.
So where did you end up after that? Like back with your mom or?
Oh, yeah. I was trying to introduce like even what I do when I end up here. Okay. So yes. Okay. So I'm trying to get to kind of just explain who I am and why I'm on your podcast. And then I'm going to dig back into that. And I think that the best way to say it is that I'm a musician. I'm a songwriter. I'm a singer. I have a lot of albums. I've been working with magic or in a magical current my whole life. And at different times throughout my musical, I mean, I don't like the word career because it feels more spiritual than that. And I don't like the word spiritual either. So I don't know what word to use, but in this whole journey of my life as a creative person, magic has been part of it. But at times, you know, I think you've probably noticed over the years, magic has come in and out of fashion as an aesthetic within music, whether or not people are materialists or are involved in any type of, you know, magical system. It's just very aesthetic and it's powerful, right? And
yep.
In and of itself, right?
There's a high performance aspect to magic. And whether or not people are just engaging in that performance, you know, as a spectacle, which by that I mean, like, they're engaging in the performance of magic without engaging in the mystical elements of magic. Then there are other artists who engage in the performance as ritual. And then the act of creating music and getting on stage and, like, producing their art is a part of this sacred ritual.
I think that whether they're conscious of it or not, that's what takes place in a live performance. Like, we're doing an ancient thing by being in bands, really, you know?
Definitely.
I think as far as using the symbolism from an ancient grimoire or, you know, an Egyptian ritual or a Golden Dawn thing and not knowing what it means or whatever, I think that there's just different levels of consciousness with it and you're interacting with it no matter what.
Yeah, I mean, I love Ghostmane, but I don't think he really knows who Crowley or John Dee are.
Yeah, didn't he like rap about John Dee?
Yes.
He might, though. I mean, it's pretty easy to find out in this age. He could be an expert on John Dee in a couple of days. You know what I mean?
I mean, maybe read the Wikipedia article, I think.
Right. But you're participating in it on some level, conscious or not, right? That's the key to everything, right?
Yes.
But with my own, like, I guess, body of work or whatever you want to call it. There were times that I occulted my magical side into it and leaned into a more like shoegaze or band kind of aesthetic. I mean, probably as a reaction to how, you know, prevalent like a witchy aesthetic was becoming when I came up. Because when I first put out my first EP, it was 2008. That EP was very influenced by like being raised by Jungian psychologists, mystic people. And it talks about basically the aether and getting lost in the collective unconscious and finding your way out. It's called Led Astray, Washed Ashore. And on the cover, I'm like in this black sea, floating upon the shore with all these gold like leaves and shells around me, right? Which is very Kabbalistic. And then the next album was The Waves. And then in that period, I just kind of was like moving away from being like hey, I'm a witch, and more just like, I'm going to occult this whatever journey I'm on into the lyrics and the feeling of the music, but investigate other like kind of genres or like the way people perceive the packaging of music.
I like that you're almost saying that you occulted the occult, as if to say, you obscured something that should have always been obscured, but has somehow found its way into more mainstream consciousness. And how do we take it back and make it hidden again? hidden in plain sight.
Or like what the judgment card and the Eon card is about, right? It's about sort of the apocalypse, right? The lifting of the veil, the destruction of the membrane that keeps the solar fire, the divine spark within, from the outward, like Malkuthian, like experience of earthly pleasures and hell, you know? And I think that the ultimate art would be something that is like both or something, you know? You know, art is, I mean, not to talk and like I'm some expert in anything, because I'm not. That's also what I need to say here, is that I'm just like a person, and I don't claim to be a teacher or anything in that way. I am opening a store, which is the reason why we decided to actually have me on the pod beyond our private conversations about magic and exchanging this kind of stuff we like. And I'll talk about that more. But yeah, I just think that the Aeon card is like about getting rid of the veils that keep you from the divine spark. And that is kind of the whole thing that is the Horus thing, right? It's like that Aeon is about sort of the destruction of the structures that are holding us back from that experience, I think. So I'm not an expert or an art critic, but I think that if art could be simultaneously aspirational and spiritual, like in a very obvious way, and then also have like occulted meaning and symbolism that speaks to people on an unconscious level, that's a really effective piece of work.
I like this being related to the shin as well, because again, if we're like thinking about the shape of the shin, which for listeners who don't know, it kind of looks like a W, but it's got like a base with three kind of hydra heads coming out of it. And with art as a concept can both unite us and demonstrate our differences. And so it's kind of this celebration of multiplicity within our shared emotional, like subconscious experience. Like you can put so many songs into the category of like love songs, but this love songs that people gravitate to is a very deep expression of their own personal relationship to their own will and their own way of feeling called to express these.
It's like the concept is to, isn't the path of this one and the path working on the tree like the path between Hode and Malkuth or something like that?
Yes, exactly.
So, well, the intellectual understanding of what your true will is and then your actual doing of it, like the combination of free will and divine will happening simultaneously, knowledge and conversation of the Holy Guardian Angel, as the Thelemites put it. And I'm not like a spokesperson for Thelema, but in all my experimentation and my path with magic, there were some key things in Thelema that I stumbled upon that were pretty life-changing. And so I should probably just tell that, because I keep referencing it. And I think like, I have friends who are actually have appointed themselves as mouthpieces for Thelema. And I'm not one of those people. I just am a person who is integrating all these ideas that are coming back into the collective consciousness in my own way, right?
In a way, I think that that's more in line with what the Aeon card represents, is like constantly subverting expectations of hegemony for this adoration and awe of the individual's place within the unity of the divine.
Right. Okay, so I'm so glad this was the card that I pulled, because I keep coming back to it now, which is like the divine spark in science has been discovered, right? In the nucleus, it's like there's a little mini version of the sun and every little atom in our body, you know, and everything. And so like we literally are scientifically proven to be as above, so below, as within, so without. Like that just exists. And you see it all the time in these scientific discoveries. Like I was listening to a podcast the other day where they said they found deep in the ocean where they think it might be like birthplace of all life on this planet. And there's these tiny little like microorganisms that are coming out that look like tiny versions of Earth bubbling up constantly out of this like very feminine, like deep, dark, like hole in the earth. Like,
wow.
Shooting. Yeah. Birthing. It's all there. Right. You know? And okay. So I like some of the Thelemic stuff. And I also am really into studying Hellenistic astrology. And we're kind of in this really interesting age for astrology where there's all these grimoires and ancient books. People might think that astrology is kind of just a known thing, but it's actually like a really exciting thing in this time that we're in, and it's changing and being reclaimed in a lot of ways, right? So when I'm thinking about the divine spark as a mirror to the sun, I'm also thinking about these discoveries of all these innumerable galaxies that we're now seeing that are these kind of mirror images of our own galaxy out in the firmament. And it's like the sun itself is a holograph of the divine. Like, you know, I mean, I'm not trying to go against like Zoroaster and be like anti-sun worshipers or thinking that the sun could be, you know, God or whatever. But I just think that there's something really beautiful about the way all these things have like a holographic fractalization throughout the cosmos, as infinite as you can imagine.
Yeah, I think that is extremely interesting. And also, I think there's something like interesting about sun worship.
I get kind of confused with the sun worshiping dudes, but I think about it in a more like Q Kabbalistic sense, because even though I come from a Jewish lineage, that's just what I've studied more than you, which is why I also like to learn from you, because you have more input on the traditional Orthodox Jewish views. I guess not Orthodox, but Kabbalist Jewish views.
No, I mean, that's what I love about you too. And actually, slightly off topic, but I'm a huge fan of Paulo Freire's Pedagogy of the Oppressed. And a lot of what he talks about in that book is the student-teacher dynamic and the, like, weird power dynamics that are created when, like, one person is fully embodying teacher all the time, always, and the other person is, like, fully embodied student and only ever embodies student. And that's, like, a part of what, at a young age, instills in children this idea of a vertical power dynamic, which is what leads to concepts like oppression and like, the oppressed. So the way that Paulo Freire kind of suggests that one subverts it is by constantly allowing yourself to be both teacher and student simultaneously. And that's, like, something I adore about our conversations is, for as much as you say you learn from me, I equally learn from you. And so it's this like reciprocity, kind of like Shin, we're constantly consuming each other's knowledge and then like regurgitating our own enlightenment of that idea, which then inspires the other person to like add more knowledge that's then regurgitated and now a new idea. And we're both ADD, so it could go on forever.
Yeah, and I think that is kind of the whole idea, again, of that card. It's about, like, the whole shift of the eon is that you're getting rid of the repression. I think Crowley was really focused on that, on the repressive side of the world, you know, like trying to be free. It's like, I think that Thelema seems like it's kind of still Christianity, but it's like he fixed some of the issues with fundamentalist Christianity and brought in all these other schools of spirituality from, you know, Tantra and Egyptian stuff and, you know, Buddhist stuff and whatever, brought it together. But at the same time, it's that particular thing seems to be about getting rid of like repression and being able to live your will without all of these things holding you back, right? And I think one of the big things that we have as human beings is these really powerful messages and teachings exist, but we tend to do it in these kind of group hierarchies. And I know about this from the way I was raised, that even when people have good intentions, you know, when you get people together, things get messy, boundaries get bad, egos get weird. And one of the most beautiful things I think about, there's something beautiful about a bad guru or like a toxic teacher. And because I think there's a lesson in it, which is that the teacher is not a god. The teacher is not above. The teacher is just a human being that has a transmission of a divine message they may not even embody or even understand. But them putting it out into the universe becomes part of the cosmic soup and the collective consciousness. And it just makes it like a, you know, a thought form out in the world. And that's divine in itself. And it's beyond the people that are talking about it or even aspiring to it, you know?
Oh, yes. I love that. And actually, that kind of, that in and of itself applies to like your concepts or your questions of Tifereth, where it's like Tifereth is just the equal balance of all opposing forces in their most harmonious way. Like, I kind of refer to Tifereth, the best way to explain it is actually through a Heraclitus fragment that just talks about it takes a taut string to produce a harmonious sound. And actually, in Kabbalistic literature, Tifereth is the place where sound is born, as well as, like, ego consciousness. I mean, we as people who are kind of still suffering from Christian ideology having really wormed its way completely through Western culture, there's so much emphasis on dualism. And in that way, there's so much emphasis on purity. And, like, I personally am a very ethical person, at least, you know, in accord to what my own ethics are. But, like, here's the thing. My ethics need to be in line with my will. And it may just so happen that, like, my will ethics align more with, like, certain Christian concepts of purity. But, you know, Osho, that guy, Wild Wild Country, he did create this, like, growth and boom of people who were kind of able to step out of what they, you know, their own Christian mindset. Maybe it wasn't like a complete subversion. It wasn't a complete 180. But even though Osho was a very materialistic man, I don't actually think he truly embodied any of the wisdom that he teaches. But there's a reason why people who are going through healing journeys will, like, look at Osho's quotes and be like, this speaks to me.
Well, I mean, that's what I'm saying is, like, there's something in the teacher role, or, like, from my understanding, I'm not an expert, but on the guru, there's something where they create agitation, like in a Lacanian, Hegelian, like, you need something to, like, get you going, you know what I mean? And, or, like, Gurdjieff, he has the Gurdjieffian shock, I think it's called, or Trungpa Rinpoche, you know, who was, like, a very complicated person himself. You know, he came up with this concept of spiritual materialism and then, I guess, like, abused his female students, and his son did it too. And that's a whole thing. But yet it doesn't take away from how powerful that concept was, and many of his concepts were, because they weren't his, right? In the same way that the divine spark is a nucleus of the sun, that we're, you know, just part of this giant firmament of stars, you know, it's like we are, it's almost like we're just cells in the, what is it, the cosmic man, they call it?
Oh, in Adam Kadmon?
Yeah, I think that's what it is, right? It's like you were tiny cells, tiny atoms within the cosmic being, right? And in the yes. same way that our body works, where cells are fighting each other, there's chaos, there's violence, there's sexuality, there's beauty, there's all these things exist within us to make us alive. We are also a part of something that's greater, right?
Yes, and that's, I think, to me, like, interestingly enough, as a person who was raised Catholic, as a person who was, like, raised in this environment of high Venusian purity, you know, and these concepts of virginity and right and wrong being so wound up tight in one's, like, even, you know, what your thoughts are. To embrace my Jewish ancestors, to, like, embrace that other side of my lineage and throw myself into Kabbalah was so healing, because there was this acceptance of the darkness. And that's why I brought up, like, I myself still have a lot of tendency towards ethics that I was taught in Catholic school. But I can now look at people who do things that I would never personally do and think to myself, you know, wow, they are playing out their own part of this grand tapestry. And there's something to admire about that. And interestingly enough, I lost a roommate over this in college, where I remember I was a philosophy student and a religious studies student, and she's, like, very new age. And I come home from class one day and I sit down and I look at her and I go, if God is everything, then God needs to be, like, famine and war and death just as much as he is peace and love. And she got so upset. She got so upset.
Just a fact. There was this, so, okay, so Have you ever seen Grant Morrison's talk at DisinfoCon in the early 2000s?
No.
So basically, I guess, okay, so, you know, I kind of came up in a Jungian mystical, like hearing about the archetypes of the tarot daily my whole life, getting readings my whole life, and very overwhelmed by that and not understanding kind of where, how much of it was just like my family and the people that raised me talking about that stuff and where it, how much of it was true or how much of it aligned with other systems. And I think a big part of me, you know, I ran away from home at 13 and I'm not an academic. I did go to school at the beginning of COVID for science stuff and herbalism and things like that. But just I'm pretty autodidactic, I guess is what it's called, right? I've been trying to, you know, just figure out things myself to kind of unpack my childhood like everyone does, but mine just happens to be really wrapped up in a magical current. And so kind of how I found magic again, outside of being an artist, which is like what I learned from the women that raised me, was that being, you know, part of the creative divine feminine side of the universe as a way to like navigate chaos was something I learned at a very young age and have used as a survival method. You know, my records are like ways that I've gotten through my life and tried to aspire to something more beautiful than the, you know, the mundane world, the torturous suffering of whatever, the demiurge or whatever. But so I kind of came back to magic was through chaos magic. And I kind of identified as a chaos witch for many years. And Grant Morrison was a big part of that because his invisible stuff and how cool, like there's this talk, right? He gets up on stage and he tells people how to do sigils. He starts the talk and he's like screaming. And then he's like, if the whole world's desires were manifest simultaneously, what would that look like? And I just thought that was really powerful, you know?
Oh, it would look like a manifestation soup. It would look like a chaos soup. This is what it would look like.
What it already looks like. Yeah, okay, so in the talk, he says, the atom bomb is nature. And that brings us back to the judgment card. But
oh, shit.
Right? But that's what he says. He's like, the fucking atom bomb is nature. You know? And it's like, that's true.
It is true.
It is true. And, you know, we are in this. So I was into the chaos magic thing and I learned the hard way, as I think, you know, a lot of chaos magicians do, that if you choose to shift paradigms at will and to do a lot of manifestation magic, you make life harder on yourself, I guess is the most simple way to put it, you know?
Yeah.
And at a certain point that led me to looking towards, I guess, what people would call high magic. And the Kabbalah and pathworking. And how I got interested in Thelema was because I stumbled upon the idea of the true will, which is obviously not created by Crowley, but he put it in a certain way and it was delivered to me as a transmission through that current. So I feel a kinship with that current. And I feel like obviously the Babylon Scarlet Woman thing has been in my music and aesthetics for a long time, even before I really knew about it. And that was an intense thing I needed to kind of journey into and discover for myself, you know? And I'm still like endlessly fascinated with the work that's being done in that. But anyways, yeah, the atom bomb is nature. And I think that in the, back to the Aeon and the judgment card, like they say that we're in the concept of the eons is like the matriarchal eon of Isis, right? And then there's the patriarchal eon of Osiris. And in the matriarchal one, we were like worshiping like cosmic, what do they call it? It's like the ladies with the cat heads and the like animal heads and female bodies, like these like chaos beings is what they call them, right? Then when we get into the era of owning property and agriculture and this is when it shifts into women being more like property and everything being like property, right? And that's the patriarchal era that we're just, I guess we're leaving now, supposedly. It seems like it, you know, like it very much seems like the Aeon of Horus, right? It's like the destruction of binary, the connection of everybody, the release from repression and the connection with your divine spark or your true will or whatever, as a synthesis, as an embodiment, which you need Babylon to do, right? Sure. But we're at the beginning of this like Aquarian age, Aeon of Horus thing, whatever you want to call it. and it's like thousands of years to go. And we're like the, just like the people ushering it in.
Well, there's chaos and transformation. I mean, I view the Aeon card often as also a Phoenix card. And it even kind of looks like that, right? With Horus being birthed out of the goddess on the card. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like, yeah, we're in the beginning period of this transition.
The Phoenix is burned by fire.
Yes, so we're all fucking on fire, running around screaming and don't know what to do.
Yes, we've come here. You can see it, right? Like the millennials and the zoomers, like so many non-binaries, like such a spectrum of people like aspiring to something higher beyond binary, beyond repression, you know? But it's so messy. And like they say that it's going to be like, so there's this quote that is a Quilly quote, and it says, there's a magical operation of maximum importance, the initiation of the new Aeon. When it becomes necessary to utter a word, the whole planet will be drenched in blood. Before man is ready to accept the law of Thelema, the great war must be fought. This bloody sacrifice is the critical point of the world ceremony of the proclamation of Horus, the crowned and conquering child, the lord of the Aeon. And so it's like, yes, I think that we have a lot of work to do. Everyone's like a baby on the internet screaming about how uncomfortable it is to go through this because it is like the crowned and conquering child. It's an aspirational child, but it's like there's blood and there's war and there's all these things that are coming with it, right? I think in that same respect, that's the tone, right? And so back to your kind of thing of teacher versus student. I have no, like, I am so appreciative for my teachers, people like you who take the time to specialize in something. I'm so ADD, I jump all over the place, but I am also a Scorpio moon and I can get really obsessed and like take in a ton of information. Mm-hmm. I just really respect people that dedicate a part of their life to really understand something and then to be able to express it and share it with other people. It's a beautiful thing and it deserves the respect of the title teacher. But at the same time, the model is very treacherous. And I don't intend to ever become a teacher. I want to be an eternal student. Mm-hmm. And having a store, I guess, like in a capitalist kind of format, like I've had to look at what do I want to do with that? And I just kind of wanted a witchy store by the sea. That was like my dream my whole life, you know, to be by the sea in a foggy coastline. Where I live is really beautiful. I think you've seen pictures. It's kind of gorgeous. Like Cornwall, England or something like that. It has
where exactly in California is it?
It's Half Moon Bay. It's south of San Francisco by like 30 minutes. But it's before Santa Cruz. It's actually a historically very magical place. There has been a lot of history here with occult groups and things like that. But I just wanted the space to be like a place where myself and artist friends of mine and occultist friends can come and sell their wares to help sustain their other pursuits. And I have a bunch of cool machines like engraver and a silk screening setup and things like that. And I just, everything is made, you know, upcycled, sustainable. I'm trying to be as like ethical in my making of things, because I just feel like a lot of times when you go into, I mean, it's not essentially just a spiritual shop. It's just a place, a creative place. But there are a lot of, it's based on the correspondences, right? I'm not trying to teach people, but I do want to make things that are rooted in these kind of things that we're all reclaiming, right? These ideas of Hellenistic astrology, the Kabbalah, the tarot. The store is called Major Arcana because it's just open. It's like the archetypes are allowed to move through at will. And I don't want to sell a bunch of like cheap tarot card things I bought, you know, from a slave trade somewhere. You know, I want to make the things, know where the stuff came from, reuse things, and try and have everything be intentional and accurate enough with the data where, like we were talking about earlier with art, it's like someone could come in off the street and buy something they know nothing about. Like I have a fixed star, like firmament series of incense I'm making that's based on the Agrippa and the Picatrix. And I'm trying to use the accurate stuff. I'm trying to do elections where I can and go by the book just to see how it works, to see how somebody who knows nothing about astrology, what that incense would do for them or how they would feel or what feedback I would get, you know, be a shared space where if someone wants to ask me a question, I'll tell them where I'm at in my consciousness at this moment, in my state, in my part of this journey. Because I think the second you put yourself in a position of authority, you hit a wall and you don't grow.
Yes, I absolutely agree. I love the idea of being a perpetual student, even if you put on a teacher's hat. Like, I don't think that we are ever done learning. And I think the minute I have this like weird anxiety, and maybe it's because of the fact that I have my Aquarius moon in the ninth house, but it's just, if I ever stopped learning, I might die. And not like a physical death, but like a soul death. Like my soul would die if I just stopped learning.
This is why you're such a good teacher, because it feels more like you're imparting the muse of excitement because you're so excited to learn.
Yes. Yes.
And I've been kind of like, I guess I've been interacting with you for like a few years now, but or a couple, I don't know. But I've seen, you know, we've shared books or been studying similar things at the same time, yet like I said, you're such a specialist and that earns you the right to be a teacher, you know? And that's a beautiful thing that is needed. It's a generous thing, you know? I'm more selfish. I just want to like learn my own shit. And no, I'm kidding. Just don't want it to be about me. And I don't really like doing interviews because I feel like I, you know, I've got ADD, I've got Mercury square Uranus. I tend to put my foot in my mouth or be misunderstood quite often. I'm very Saturnian. And I feel like an outsider a lot, but I'm doing this thing and I trust you and I really like where you're coming from. And I've learned a lot from you. And in fact, things you've shared on your Patreon, I've done rituals that you've suggested and they've been life-changing. So I just felt like this was a good place to come as Saturn's voice, right? Here we are being the voice of Saturn.
Oh, yeah. Speaking of that, the election for when this podcast airs has Saturn and the moon in Aquarius in the seventh house. So it's basically two Saturn witches sitting and sharing their emotions of grief and suffering with each other.
Yeah.
So I love that.
Yeah,
and I love
so
you.
Far, we haven't even really talked about Saturn. I love you too. We haven't really talked about Saturn that much because I think we've just been talking about like what age we're in right now. And kind of like what our roles are in this time. And that's kind of what I've been thinking about, you know, since I started doing kind of more, I guess, ceremonial magic more heavily around like 2018, I was having visions of the apocalypse and I was really getting into like Babylon kind of ideas. And then the COVID thing happened and I was living in London and I ended up having a lockdown here in California. I was just kind of sent here. I had no intention to be here. But I had already had set the intent to go on magical retreat, essentially, and to learn all these things and try to unpack like who I was, because I definitely, I think other people can identify with this experience of I had gone through like a very intense sort of tower card moment around that time. It really started in 2015 and it went for like 5 years, but that was a big, hard, like, something has to change moment. And when I, you know, discovered kind of the concept of the true will, even though I had kind of avoided anything curly or anything like that up until that point, even though I had been going to like the Annie Besant Lodge and Theosophical Society and taking Gnostic pathworking classes and groups and studying magic of all kinds for many years, I had avoided that because I thought it was even though it's not kind of mainstream, or like maybe it was more like Magic the Gathering than magic that I imagine. You know what I mean? But then that's the thing about that, like all the edgelordery and all the Crowley personality and all the things that are a turn off. It's almost like that's an initiation, right, to get past, because there is interesting information there. You know, I think you got to take it from there, or you don't have to, but one could take it from there and create their own path or rituals or system or cosmology or whatever. But the concept of the true will just gave me this kind of consciousness shift where I was like, fuck, all of these experiences that I've had that I identified as a victim in, or that I felt like I was never supposed to be born, I was an accident, and life was just chaos, you know? It shifted when I realized that perhaps that's what I wanted. Perhaps I was complicit in every toxic relationship I ever had, and every painful choice I ever made. And this is obviously like very complicated and delicate subject. Like, I'm not trying to victim shame people or anything like that. I don't want to get into that. It's like, you know, especially with children and things like that, you know, it's a complicated topic, but there's something valuable to taking responsibility for the fact that maybe that shitty ex-boyfriend I had that cheated on me and like abused me, there is something that I wanted from that and I got from that. What is it that I like about that? You know, and it was really liberating and I'm still on that journey. But once I kind of had that shift of consciousness, I felt like I had a paintbrush for the universe. And I felt like I could just go to this town and have a beautiful garden and make music and have a beautiful, you know, I run a farm. I run a lettuce, hydroponic lettuce operation as my other job. And I work in greenhouses and farms. And that's a really cool technology that it could change the way people eat. And, you know, with all these supply chain issues and whatever, I just chose to consciously try and you can get neurotic, obviously, and I'm sure I sound neurotic, but to consciously choose to do what people, I guess, refer to as shadow work, to every day look at my actions versus my intentions and say, okay, yes, I identify as a good person and I identify as an artist and all these things, you know, and when I'm alone, I feel like a fucking goddess and everything's beautiful. Yet I go to the grocery store and I yell at somebody if that body checks me in an aisle. I still can be a fucking bitch. And what are those actions? Where are they coming from? You know, and not just in a psychoanalytical way, like go to therapy, tell your problems, they're gone, because they don't go away. But like just to strive for a level of higher awareness where I can see myself better than I've been choosing to see myself up until this point.
You know, well, that made me think of a couple of things. The first is like this difference between like victim shaming and taking responsibility kind of lies in how much control you really had over a situation and also like how much empathy you're giving yourself even for making mistakes, right? So I know good and well that in my violent, abusive relationship, I chose to stay. I mean, and there are a multitude of different psychological reasons why someone would choose to stay in a relationship like that. And it doesn't do me necessarily any good to just sit there and say, like, I was a stupid dumbass for not leaving. Because obviously it was complicated, but still, at the end of the day, you're right. There was some need, some impossible desire that I felt like I was gaining in that, even if it was misguided, even if it was distorted. And that's like this idea of the shadow, it's obscured. And so that kind of leads me to the second point, which is my thoughts on like how one deals with shadow, like deals with these things that might make them attracted to violence or might make them attracted to chaos, or like you kind of so beautifully and aptly pointed out to me on our phone conversation yesterday, why I may, you know, seek out pleasure in pain as a saturnal person. And I don't know, it's like yesterday I went to the museum and there was this painting and it was like this beautiful garden and ocean scene, but then all the ocean was like dumping out onto the shore all of these sea monsters and sea slugs. And again, we're like talking about the dark feminine, the ocean, the monsters of Lilith that reside within that depth of the ocean.
Kenneth Grant's like Typhonian, like that whole vibe, the squid, yes. Sex and priestesses.
Yeah. And that actually does have its foundation in Jewish, you know, Kabbalistic lore, even in this book that I was reading by Jill Hammond, I think her name is. It was called The Under Torah, and it was all about dreams and like working the dream space through a Kabbalistic mindset. And one of the chapters was on shadow integration and nightmares, dealing with nightmares. And there was this dream. It was like such a sink because I read this chapter the day before I went to the museum and saw this painting. So it was like fresh in my mind. The dream that this woman had had, she had always been getting chased by sea monsters. And in one dream, she finally is for some reason like taller than the sea monster, where the sea monster is kind of like miniature now. And she takes the sea monster and she shoves it up her vagina. And then it kind of becomes this ball of light within her solar plexus that then permeates through the rest of her body, where she, in her dream, she like starts radiating gold. And that to me is like the alchemic process. It's the Hieros Gamos. It's shadow work. It's basically saying like, my shadow isn't separate from me. It's not something that I need to get rid of, because violence is a part of nature. Violence is a part of life. If there are parts of me that is attracted to violence, how can I express that in a way that's actually balanced with mercy? How can I balance Gevura with Chesed and create the perfect Tifereth, in which I embody both destruction and creation without shame? And that's really what Catholicism has attacked us by implanting, or Christianity as a whole, by like implanting shame in our claiming of Gevura. And so then everything of Gevura becomes bad. Anger becomes bad. Any kind of sex becomes bad. Violence becomes bad. But without tension, we have no creation. Without the tension of Gevura and Chesed, without the tension between Nesach and Hod, we don't have music. We don't have song. We don't have color. It's just this grotesque embodiment of one archetype that is stale because there's no depth. It's like when you look at a painting of somebody who didn't add any shadow and it just looks flat, and you don't enjoy it the same way as when they like include all the wrinkles and all the depths of shadow and space.
Right, like the atom bomb is nature, right?
Yes.
I think that that's the whole goal, right? I was going to talk about, I thought we were going to lead into talking about like Lacan and all of that kind of jouissance and the object A, and that pleasure actually, according to those dudes, is pain. You know, like that's the first thing you have to admit, is that desire in itself is the pain. It's a yearning. The fulfillment is pretty short, the period of, you know, orgasm or whatever, right? But then you've like shifted into this whole Kenneth Grant like territory, which I'm super fascinated by. It takes the Babylon thing and the to this like priestesshood. It's kind of like what Amidali talks about as well, who I think is probably the most interesting person working in that current, but you know, it's not a competition, but she's definitely got like her own system. She's going to put out a book about how to initiate into it, but she has a lot of really great essays online. But it seems to be like she's working with the Enochian angels, and they're the female ones, and she's doing all of this work that is magical, that's actually based in the female biology and changing it. Like there's this whole thing, as in the same way that magic in general, like, you know, the Hebrew words and all these letters and stuff like that, vibrating them, it's a technology. There's something in that current that there's a technology about like evolving the human body. And that's the Babylon thing. Like it's embodied. That's what Babylon manifests as, dancers and sex workers. And it's not just intellectuals or artists. It's so much of the flesh.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and but yeah, there's this Kenneth Grant thing that has all these like sea monsters, and they mix like tantra with this kind of like, he was kind of the first one, I think, in the current to talk more about like the importance of the woman as a priestess, as her body, as like a magical weapon, more than like this role of the scarlet woman being like, you know, a manic pixie dream girl to the ceremonial magician's personal enlightenment or whatever.
Yeah.
Not that that's what it is, but it could be seen that way.
So it's like the real version of Jezebel, because historically speaking, the Jezebel of the Bible was a priestess. She was likely a priestess of Asherah or maybe Anath, which did involve sacred sex. They had the Kadesha were prostitutes. And ironically, that's the word for holy, Kadesh.
Yeah, of course. But, yeah, so yeah, the like, temple priestess, definitely a sexual. I mean, come on. Okay, so like the first thing that we ought to say is like, I don't know, magic is like a big word, right? But what is it? It's sexual energy focused in different ways. It has to be. Kundalini, the chi, the life force energy is sexual energy, right? Like,
yes.
Sex and death are the only two true forces in the world.
You know this is my favorite mystical archetype. You know you're barking up the right tree here.
Yeah, because it's the one.
Yes, it is the one.
Yeah, and this is part of that repression that needs to go away. And I think that a lot of times people think that doing their shadow work or doing their, you know, facing their dark side is like going to the dungeon and acting out their kink to get rid of whatever thing created the kink, you know, but like I'm suggesting, like, let's go deeper and admit what we want, because our sexual energy is our power. Like the thing that you were saying, I think you were saying something a moment again about like things that seem bad are actually powerful. I myself have experienced that as a huge lesson. Things that I identified with myself as weaknesses, I now see are my core source of power. You know, I have this Scorpio moon. It makes me incredibly obsessive and intense. And when channeled right, that makes me unstoppable at making anything I want happen or learning anything.
The Scorpio moon, you do have a little bit more of extra manifestation going on than maybe some of the other signs.
Yeah, you might call it psycho or you might call it power.
Yes, depending on how it's utilized by the natal.
Yeah, it's very connected to the libidinal drive, right? And that's the thing, you know, like people like to say that I feel like I'm making a case for all these bros, all these like spiritual bros, which I don't want to do, but I went and studied those guys because people say it's bad. They say that Freud's only obsessed with his dick. They say Crowley just made everything about sex, but you know what? The Kabbalah is about sex.
Yep.
And the human life is about sex. The divine feminine, all of this is one creative emanating from sphere to sphere, simultaneous, pumping, throbbing logos or whatever.
So what you're saying is that Earth is just one big being orgy.
Yeah, I just think that that's one of the first things that people really need to be honest about, because it's the first thing that gets used against them.
Yeah.
Like when you're talking about Venusian, I'm not going to name any like spiritual groups and talk bad about them because it's I don't want to talk bad about them. I love them all. They all are valuable. You know, and I just think that there are interesting things to learn. Like if you look at certain religions that are more Venusian versus certain religions that are more Saturnian, what do you see in the dark side, in the shadow? In the Venusian religions, you see child abuse, sexual issues, Venusian issues, people yep. stealing the power of sex from other people or controlling it or controlling the power of reproduction. And when you look at the more Saturnian religions, what do you see? You see blood sacrifice and murder and war. Right?
Yes.
It's totally different.
And that's a very good point, because it's like, no matter how much we try to escape the darkness, even if we want to say, okay, we're going to progress from a Saturnian way of doing religion into a more Venusian way of doing religion, it is impossible to get rid of darkness. That didn't solve any real problems that people had with Saturnian type religions. You see it happening in politics, too. It's like, think about the French Revolution and, like, how the cause was just, but nobody had really thought to themselves, how can we do it differently? And so then they just repeated the cycle of oppressor and oppressed because they had never really attempted to look beneath the base level suffering. Like, I am suffering because I am being oppressed. So if I destroy my oppressor, then I am free. But then maybe that's true to some degree, but now you are the oppressor of some other class or some other group of people, and you haven't really resolved anything within the grand scheme of the world at large.
It's as unspiritual as it gets to put up boundaries. I'm not nationalistic. I don't want to get too political because people will be offended by the things I have to say, because I just don't believe in nationalism. I think that all political ideologies and religions are shared group fantasies, and we agree to them. You know, we want to put a president as the bad guy who we can't fight, we can't do anything to. He just does all these bad things, and it's not my president. It's like, no, it is your president. You want to sit, I'm talking to you on an iPhone right now that was made in outsourced slavery. It's like, I'm complicit and I'm agreeing in a collective karmic sense that we all are, to put that in the shadow and to make Big Daddy the bad guy. And
that is what happens in exoteric religions, right? We give the power to like a patriarchal figure who tells us what God thinks. And then when something goes bad, we ask forgiveness or we blame them, you know? And I think that I'm not trying to like change the history of religion or anything, but I just think personally, the first step is to admit that you're getting something out of suffering and that there's a power, there's a malefic purpose, right? There's a purpose to the shadow. And maybe there's even an incredible power there, because in my own personal life, I've noticed that when I allow myself to identify as very vulnerable or out of control or that bad things are happening to me, more things like that happen because I'm not taking responsibility for the fact that I have an immense power that other people sense. And when I myself identify as weak, they feel that power on a subconscious level as an attack. And so I have to, as my great work, keep introspecting and keep relating to other people in a way where it's mirroring back to me exactly what this power is. And so I can have it as a conscious synthesis in my day-to-day life to be aligned with my will or whatever you want to call it. So it doesn't act against me. So there's that thing of like, own your power so it doesn't own you or whatever.
Yeah, and interesting, we've been talking a lot about the Aeon card, but we've also been talking a lot about Babylon, who is the lust card. And that's very much what you're talking about here. It's like, you can try and chain that dog up and put it in a cage, but it's just going to escape and cause a lot of damage eventually. Like, you can only keep it chained up for so long. You might as well learn how to ride it. And that also kind of applies to what we were talking about with true will, too, because it's like, as long as you are hiding from certain parts of yourself and afraid to look at them or afraid to, like, really get to know what it is that you truly want. And also, no shame, because this can be a light, again, perpetual student. You may never get to the exact bottom of what it is you truly want. But you can start to notice, you know, when I do X, I may think it's because of Y, but it's actually because of Z. And just knowing that.
You just have to stop analyzing your intentions and analyze your actions more. And that's so hard to do because you're living in a constant state of self-analysis and experience in your own mind. Your eyes don't look inwards. They look outwards. You know, this is why having a therapist is a good idea. Not that I have one, because I can't afford the kind of therapist I want, right? I was raised by therapists and it was a very complex thing. But my understanding of good use of a therapist is not just to have somebody to emotionally dump on so you don't emotionally dump on your friends, which I guess is useful, obviously. But that just seems to be like the general take on why you need a therapist, which I think is weird because it's like, no, your friends should be there for you. But I get there's a line, you know. I think it's more like the therapist can see you doing your bullshit that you can't see, and they are supposed to name it, right? They're supposed to say, why are you trying to make me hate you? Why are you trying to make me be sexually attracted to you? Transference, jouissance, all that shit, right? Like the things you cannot see. And I think that at the very least, admitting that that's the case would be so useful in general right now, because I think that people feel forced to have very strong opinions on everything right now. They're forced to take a side and say it publicly and be held to it and be angry about it. And I think that's really powerful. Like, I'm kind of an anarchist and I would love to see, you know, big changes be made in the world, but I don't know if they come from being in a hysterical state on the internet, talking in this, like, dilemma again, like Karanzonic, like babbling of the demon in the abyss that is distracting you. Like, I don't want to be on Twitter because it's basically the thoughts in my own mind that I'm trying to get rid of everybody's at once, you know?
I mean, let's talk about that for a minute, because with this, like you're saying, this like age of Aquarius and this age of like air sign, great conjunctions between Jupiter and Saturn that are going to be happening in air signs, I think for the next 250 years, but I may be wrong about that. Sorry to any professional astrologer out there. But a lot of things now are kind of being moved into this Aquarian, like fixed, airy, like we're looking from this lofty place of mind down at what we have built. And so in that way, because the energy of the stars even are motivating us into this more analytical, you know, and to a certain degree, it's probably a good thing in some ways, but we also kind of have to fight it in others and fight this desire to be totally in our thoughts and in our mind and in logic. I mean, there's a reason why in tarot, the swords cards are generally, you know, anxiety, verbal arguments, nightmares.
Buddhism is just about getting rid of the thoughts in your mind, you know, because they're the suffering. Yeah.
Or just to be able to identify all of our thoughts as being empty and of any true value set that, you know, Western philosophic systems are always trying to put values on every single concept. And in Buddhism, it's really just like, hey, all concepts are on the universal level. Like if we're, they would never say it like this, but if we're at Keter, all concepts are valueless. That idea doesn't happen until you get further down the tree and things become more messy the more further down the tree that you go, because you start to get these concepts. The very first concept is opposition, like the other and the I, and the distinction between them. And that initial three-way opposition and tension created between the three supernals, we would never get any ability to place value on things if it wasn't for this.
That's the point. And that's the Babylon thing. And also, that's kind of what I'm saying is like, I think it's beautiful that we're aspiring towards to get past binary in a very public way, in a very mainstream way. You can see it manifesting, you know, and you can see the current of Babylon and these archetypes of, you know, the Scarlet Woman, whatever, are getting used and stuff like that. And that's really awesome. But you cannot skip the steps, right? And I think to get beyond binary, we have to look at the truth of what we've done within binary and within each step. We do have to unrepress the divine feminine, the dark feminine, look at it and see what it's complicit to. What does the dark feminine actually even fucking mean? Is it just like a sexy chick in a red outfit? No, it's like, it's a side of ourselves that has been simultaneously hidden and repressed and abused and also is hiding. And why? You know, these are all the things I want to kind of think about on the way up the tree, you know? And I think the just kind of admitting that we don't know anything and admitting that we don't consciously really know what our intentions are would be so healing, you know? And that's what I want to do, because I'm not a perfect person by any means. And all of these ideas have come to me from trauma and experiences of chaos created or otherwise. And to even get past this thing of being like responsible for the things in your life, because then there's also the aspect of the harsh determinism that astrology suggests, that down to every word you say, things might just be determined anyways. But that doesn't, that's kind of what I was talking about in the beginning with the judgment card. It's like something about bringing together the experience of free will and divine will as a synthesis, right? And there, I don't know. I just think the process of that is like taking responsibility and analyzing what you really want, because you usually are getting what you want in life. And if you have a shitty life, then, I mean, obviously people who are born in third world countries, and it's like, it's super difficult to talk about. Just like talking about being Jewish and having magic. I don't want to start getting into like theosophical root races and stuff like that. It's so hard to talk about ancestral things because you can go right there, you know? And I just don't know. It's such treacherous territory, but I think it's just worth, at least on an introspective level, looking into and being honest about with ourselves person by person.
Yeah. And I mean, again, like we're not talking about binaries. So like your statement of this doesn't mean that what you're saying is always true for every case of something bad happening to someone. It's just that there are plenty of cases in which bad things are happening to you that it is because you have this innate subconscious desire to repeat the pain pleasure process.
Right. And maybe that desire is like inspired by the fact that, you know, when you're in the alignment with what you're supposed to emanate into the world or whatever, your purpose.
Well, that's like a tough question that I wrestle with, right? Because it's like, again, going back to this, I do still kind of you know, withhold a lot of my Catholic ethics, just in terms of like, you know, I am a person who would rather us have world peace. I am an anarchist. I would rather us all show compassion for our fellow brother and sister. That happens to be my own will. But one of the, like, most gut-wrenching, like, truths, like that Three of Swords moment of sorrow because you come to an understanding of a truth that's greater than yourself was, like, even people who literally gain pleasure from causing the rest of the world pain. Like, I'm not going to think of the most extreme example, but let's use, like, Jeff Bezos. Jeff Bezos is destroying the earth, and he is making so many things about the human experience worse, the social, you know, and class disparity worse. What if that is him following his true will? Who am I to say, right? I mean, I can long for things like universal peace and like brotherhood amongst all men, but like, who am I to speak the will of God? God is everything. And that means that people like Jeff Bezos could actually be engaged in their divine purpose by starting Amazon, as much as I think Amazon is a scourge.
I think it's probably the best way to just live your life thinking that way, because just assuming that everyone's doing their will, you know, and that your job is to do yours. But at the same time, you can get a really nihilistic approach or just give up, you know?
Well, that's the Saturn thing. This feeling that maybe all conscious living is suffering implicitly. And is that worth it? And why would it be worth it? But you're right. Like, those are questions that you can begin to ask yourself, especially if you have Saturn conjunct moon in the fucking ninth house. And it can lead to intense depression. I would say I get more depressed about existential philosophy and like philosophical pessimism than most other things. And the way that I kind of subvert it is just, I have to take a step back and I have to go, I am in awe at suffering. I am in awe of the beauty of the way that fire consumes the forest. You know, I am in awe at the churning, and this concept of awe being both awesome and awful. It's both combined in one. And in that, whenever I find myself falling into philosophical pessimism, I basically just go, even this feeling is awesome. It is awful. And I allow myself to be in that feeling without placing any expectations on it until it passes. And I find myself in more, you know, a more mundane emotional mood.
Yeah. Well, it is awesome. Literally, the definition of that word explains that, because it's chaos, right? And Saturn, Binah, Babylon, like the great mother, you know, the birthing and the destruction simultaneously, perfectly balanced. Like when you watch any films on the cosmos and Earth and how everything is intrinsically linked, like every grain of sand on a beach was shit out some fish's ass. And like, you know, like everything is interacting. The air I'm breathing now is going to travel all the way around the world, you know, and someone else is going to breathe it on the other side of the world. And there's death, and there is famine, and there's violence, and there's love, and there's perfection, and there's beauty, and there's art, and all of these things are emanating, right, at the exact same moment. And that brings me joy. I think what the suffering is trying to control that. I'm saying I'm responsible for my experience of my life, you know, like, but maybe I'm not responsible for the events or the people. Maybe it's a long karmic snowball of things that have happened over many lifetimes, and this is why I'm in these things again. And consciously, I'm not making, you know, in this lifetime, I didn't choose to create these storylines. They were there as echoes from the past. I don't know, or was all determined, and it's just, I have to be like a stoic and just figure out how to deal with it as gracefully as possible. I don't know. These are the things that I ask myself. How, I'm not supposed to know. I like that I can't ever know. All I know is that you could either just give up by being so overwhelmed with the evil of the demiurge and the fucking Armon or whatever, you know, like you could get totally hopeless, and then you get in that, you become like a materialistic tech bro and you don't care about anything. You know, you do the Jeff Bezos. Like, I don't think that Jeff Bezos, well, I don't know Jeff Bezos, but I think people of that caliber of capitalists that are really successful and are at a certain echelon, they believe in the model. And the model is I'm providing a service for people that they like, and I'm being rewarded because I'm giving something to people that they want. And that's actually true. It's like what I was saying. It's like, we want to order stuff on Amazon. Even the people that are yelling about Jeff Bezos do it. And I think that we have to just look at ourselves first. I'm trying to look at myself and it's an endless fucking thing. And it can be neurotic. I don't want to go there. I think that the destiny or the true will is relating to other people and love and growing human consciousness within that aspect of the way we can connect, building the light, getting in flow with the universe, you know, like that's why I like all the correspondences and things like that. It's the Hermetic order, not the initiating into the Masonic temple, but the Hermetic order of all things, like to learn the mathematical formulas of the angels and the elements and the eons and all these things. They come together in a way that you can surf chaos, and chaos and suffering become part of the joy of the experience of life.
Yeah, that reminded me that, you know, maybe I am, sometimes I do this where I say one thing and then I realize that there have been other times that I've thought differently.
Paradox.
Yes.
It's the magic. Paradox exists in all things. And when you find that out, then you know that you know nothing.
Oh, that's
the most magical thing in the world.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But yeah, so with the whole like Jeff Bezos following his true will thing, a part of why I really, actually, one thing of Crowley's that I really love and the thing that I've fell in love with before I really even fell in love with magic, I kind of like heard this saying from him before I learned anything else, the love under will, love is the law. And that to me was always the answer to, okay, well, if I'm just going to follow my true will, then that means fuck you. And I'm just going to do whatever I want. It's so wrong. And so in that way, there's no way in hell Jeff Bezos is actually engaged in his true will, because he's not, his will isn't being based out of love for all.
That's complicated, because you don't know the divine love of God or whatever, right?
So paradox, it's like, again.
He's the agitator or whatever. I don't know. I'm not Jeff Bezos by any means. Please don't put me in that position. But I'm just saying that.
No, but we are playing devil's advocate.
Yeah, for sure. When, and like we said, I'm no expert. I'm just some runaway chick in a band who has opinions about this stuff, you know? But do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. You know, it's like love under will. It's like people misunderstand that. I think it's been talked about enough, but basically, you know, it doesn't mean do whatever you want or everything's permitted. It means that there is a true thing you really want that's aligned with the whole. The love part, in my eyes, is the thing that connects you to the collective, right? Like your will, the whole concept of having a divine will is that you're supposed to emanate something into the group, into the project of, like, if you believe in reincarnation and what, like, you know, the different schools of religion that do believe in that say, you know, they say that we were so many different things in so many different realms. It took us so long to incarnate to get here now to paradise. In a, you know, I don't know how many galaxies it's going to be until we find another thing similar to the human project, but it's incredibly rare. And to come here and bitch about it and just submit to the suffering and not strive in any way to be aspirational, to contribute to the love aspect of it. You know, when the Buddhists say there's like that net with the lights connect, you know, that's the important thing. When the consciousness come together, we're divided in order to reconnect, to find that. That's the beauty of it. And that's in the way that we're talking about, like the cosmic man. We're a cellular, we're part of like a system of cells in a body of a cosmic man. You know, it's like, we have to come together and work together to grow this consciousness. We are a collective. We have collective karmas that need to be addressed, but until you address your own mini as above, so below collective karmic story, it has to start with you. Because if you just point fingers, that's when you get the guru that rapes you, you know? Yes. Like, everybody understands these concepts. Like, love is good, God is good. Yeah, we get it. But like, how do you embody that? And I'm going off here, but I just, while I have this in my mind, like, you were talking about how people are getting more and more on the cloud, right? Like, more internet, more separated from each other, more hypnotized by the algorithm, and, you know, narcissistically in love with their own perfectly curated world where everyone agrees with them or fights with them just enough to get them off or whatever, you know? And like, we've got all these transhumanist tech dudes that are, you know, ready to put chips in our brain, just get rid of us, actually, because there's like probably a 2.0 Android that will do us better. These are all real concepts that are being talked about in the world at this very moment. And I think that it's so interesting that simultaneously we have this Babylon current that, you know, I keep saying Babylon, and obviously that's like a Crowley term, and like, she's way older than that. But I do like it as a model to talk about, because it's just, I see it everywhere. It's not just me. I look around and I find it everywhere. And when I meet like really close friends of mine who are like these powerful, like female front people, I mean, some of my best friends, even people who have hurt me the most, are in that current. It's a real thing. I was born into it. My family had it. My friends have it. I look at their charts. They all have these really tight Pluto aspects that feel like this lifting of the veil, this apocalyptic shadow work, divine feminine thing. And her thing is about the flesh. It's in the body. And that's just so interesting that she would come now at a time when there's like a war for us to not be in our bodies. The sexual energy is the core of our power, and it gets abused in these religious organizations because they know that they're getting power by doing that. It feeds the egregore, right? And to take that and put it into your own flesh, to have your experience of sexuality as divine and powerful and something sacred that you can channel into art or a family or, you know, a book, whatever. This is something that exoteric religions and exoteric systems try to take away from people. And that is the value of an esoteric practice and of magic being in the mainstream and in the consciousness right now. It's the value of it. You know, it's not a trend. It's a birthright.
No, yeah, absolutely. If you actually commit to this path, you have to commit to suffering. It's not a way to subvert suffering. And interestingly enough, I went from studying Buddhism into magic simply because my Saturn ass couldn't conceive of a mystic tradition that didn't embrace the reality of suffering and the necessity of it and the joy of it.
Yeah, because you really do like it, you know? And so you especially don't want to tell yourself that. Otherwise, it's not fun.
Wow. Yeah, let's just point out my own impossible desire for the whole podcast world to hear.
I'm just saying.
It's true.
It's applicable to everyone.
Yes.
To the point, kind of, I feel like I'm going around in circles because that's how I am, you know, and my brain's kind of all over the place. But I just think, yeah, step one, just admit that we want. And so what I'm doing with these things I'm making in my little shop, and, you know, I'm going to have a booth as a vendor at Norwalk, like the big astrology conference, because I just, some of the greatest minds in the world are going to be talking there. And I am making things that are not, that have this bit of a spin on it, right? Like, I'm doing some spell candles and things, but they're not to manifest money or not that there's anything wrong with that, because I don't really believe in the low magic, high magic thing. I think you need it all to happen at once, you know?
Oh, well, with the low magic, high magic thing, it's like you need angels and demons. You need Keter and Malkuth to embody the perfect Adam, Kadmon, and Tifereth.
Yes, we want to bring heaven to earth, right? So we need both.
Yes.
And I think that you got to look at the shadowy sides, you know, the shells, right? And so some of the candles I'm making are, instead of like a love spell, it's an Eros and Psyche spell. Like, what do I really want? What is really driving my libidinal actions in the world? That's a shadow work candle. That's something to meditate on.
Oh, yeah.
You know? Or like, there are shadow aspects to everything. Like, I have a Juno and Jupiter kind of like partnership candle, right? And like, in one level, that could be, you know, I want to get married, but it's also what it makes a stable, real commitment. What is that? Why do I want it? you know, like these kinds of things I think are worth meditating on because, okay, I think that, you know, we tell younger people a lot, like, you'll understand one day. I'm 40, by the way. Like I said, I left home at 13. I've been in music scene since that. And I had a lot of people kind of doing that to me when I was younger. And I don't think that any young person's ever learned anything from that. But I feel that maybe trying to explain it and like there are consciousness shifts that happen. Time doesn't exist, but veils of reality get lifted at certain, you know, points in your cosmic wheel.
Yeah.
And I just think it's valuable to think of magic not only as manifesting or new thought or trying to make things happen, but to actually just look at what you're already doing because everyone's doing magic all of the time. We're all manifesting constantly. So if you're not manifesting what you want, maybe just admit to yourself you do want it and figure out why.
You know, that is actually so true. Even in our spell work, oftentimes I'll find whenever certain spells that I try that just don't work, they just go flat. It was because I didn't actually want it to come true. It was just that I thought I needed it for whatever reason. Like during the pandemic, yeah, I was like doing spells to like, you know, have all these tarot readings, make all these tarot readings happen. So I'll be busy doing tarot readings and making money because I have scarcity issues. And I wanted the business to like grow really quickly, whatever. But they weren't working. Like, it wasn't working. I wasn't getting readings. And I, you know, like, that always is kind of like a sting of pride for a magician. Like, why isn't my fucking spell working? But when I sat down and I really thought about it, I realized, like, I don't want to be working right now. I really just don't. There's, like, no motivation or drive or, like, true force of intent and will that I'm putting into this spell because I don't actually want it to happen. What I want is for me to just be safe and secure financially while taking some downtime and, like, resting before I actually do have to go back to work.
Right.
That's what happened. Like, I did receive that. I got, you know, unemployment income, and it was just enough to, like, help me pay my rent and get my groceries, and that was really all I needed. And I got to, like, take a good couple months break from doing any real labor, and it was actually really nice.
Yeah, I think that that's the lesson, like, I was talking about before being in the chaos path is, like, you go, I want this thing, and then it creates, like, a chaotic reaction. And you realize like it causes an agitation or a pain that inspires you to kind of go to fine tune closer to what you really want, you know, or what your true will or whatever the fuck you want to call it is. You know, I think that that's a gift. That's a Saturnian gift. It's a gift to be given a boundary, you know, without boundaries, we're just chaos. Like, and chaos has a bad rep, but like chaos in its oldest understanding of it, it's like this primal, to like you said, churning force of energy that is the endless potential of all the beautiful things of being alive, as well as the suffering. And you will get both. Like, one of the really cool things I like about astrology is that when you look at natal placements, they can mean a multitude, a multiverse, or whatever of things. And usually throughout your life, all of those things manifest. It means a multitude of things, you know?
Yes, and honestly, like, that's beautiful. Like I said, you don't want to look at a painting that doesn't have any depth. An oil painting that doesn't have any shadows, it's boring. It's not realistic.
And these supposedly, like, benefic planets, like, they have bad side effects, too. Like, Venus is, you know, in Vedic astrology, like, I think, like, the queen of demons. And, you know, I just think that there's something to needing the other that really taps into that libidinal drive and the shadows of it that comes out through Venusian stuff, like we were talking about in the exoteric Venusian orders. But then Jupiter, you know, you could get a huge ego, or you could get fat or gluttonous, or like things could expand so much that it's bad, right? You need Saturn to come in and create a beautifully refined, gorgeous architecture to carry these gifts within. And you need Mars to come in and be willpower and strength and sexual force and all of these things to get things going. We need to just admit that everything has paradox And that is actually the true joy of life, is within that paradox.
Literally, if everybody could just embrace the paradox, that it would be like my biggest desire that I would like to see. If there's one thing that I want people to like move into by that they actually can achieve by using mental logic, it's the understanding of X equals X and not X simultaneously. There's really no distinction between the two.
Yes. I always say in tarot readings to people, like, at least two things are true. You know, it's just like, it's like there's not a real black or white thing to anything. And when there is, that's where the suffering starts. Like when you want to control other people, you know, like when you get a tarot reading and people are like, I do this too. You know, I'm not immune to any of this. I am speaking as the person with all the problems trying to figure them out, you know? But like when you go to a tarot reader and you ask, what is the guy thinking about me? It's like, that's sad. Like ask the fucking guy. Like there is like this thing of just, he probably wants you and doesn't want you, but he doesn't know until you're there. Like intimacy happens in person. It's not a fantasy, you know? It's like, that's a real thing that can't be an illusion. It's face to face, you know? And but we want to talk to our girlfriends and do tarot readings and get in a like a fantasy about it. And that's cool. Divination is useful, but the paradox of it is true. Like I think I'm not explaining this well.
I think you're explaining it great, actually. And I feel called out in a beautiful way.
I'm not passive aggressively calling you out, but I'm just saying that the paradox is the key, right? It's like you're simultaneously being rejected by someone and you're simultaneously wanting to be rejected. Both things are true. You are being hurt and you enjoy it. But equally, right? The pain is just as bad as the yes. pleasure. And some people are addicted to that more than others. I myself am somebody who is very, very addicted to that. My music, you know, I'm heavily Saturnian, as we've said in this reading, in this podcast. All my main lords, masters, whatever, are Saturn. My Egyptian bounds with my other planets are Saturnian or old, you know, but I have a Venus rising, and I have Venus is the second note in the perfume that is me. And my music is that, right? It's like these bittersweet songs about love, but always about the Saturnian boundaries within love. When you have to let go, when you have to forgive, when you have to admit you're the bad guy, all these things, right?
Yeah.
These are the topics that interest me or that just come out of me. So I'm not an authority. I'm just an embodiment of it. And so I realized that when I read tarot, you know, I've had plenty of tarot readings over the years where people are kind of manipulative or use it as a way to get really close or control other people. That does happen. And so why I started doing tarot readings, for me, not that I'm, this is a goal, right? This is the conscious intent. We'll see what the unconscious actions are. But my conscious goal with tarot is to just give the data and allow people to take those symbols and hopefully get some use out of them. That's why I like to study tarot with people like you, who are getting down to the nitty gritty, the decans and the Hebrew letters and all of the, you know, Kabbalistic correspondences and such, because I want to know enough consciously that unconsciously I can just tell people kind of the combinations of these things, and through the honest data, without too much personal projection or myth making on my end, they can connect it to their own personal mythologies.
Yep. Oh yeah, that's absolutely my approach to tarot. I don't like it when people try to get hyper specific, as you saw in my class.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that it's so much more nuanced than that. And the only time, I think it gets a little bit more iffy and more complicated when you like progress as a diviner and as a sorceress both, and you start bringing in like spirits that help the readings be more accurate. There's maybe a little bit of leeway there to where your intuitive knowing of which layer of these various data, like matrix sets of data, that you're actually pinpointing at.
Yeah.
Often, like, I don't think that you've actually gotten a reading from me.
No, I wanted to wait till after the pod.
That's honestly probably for the best. But yeah, so that is kind of how I try to do it.
That's a whole nother language you're adding. It's like you have all of the spirits and all of the elements that are already in the deck that were added by the Golden Dawn and the ones that were already there prior to that. And then you have it through process through. It's almost like when you go get a reading from someone else and they have their own interpretations of the card in language, you're doing that with like another spirit.
Yes.
Awesome. That's how you are. And that's how you roll. And that's why I have mad respect for you. Maybe I'll get there, but right now I'm just trying to, I got to get to a place where I feel like I trust my consciousness enough to not let any hungry ghosts in a fear. So
that's the hardest part. That is right there, I think, the diviner's struggle. Like, it's always easier to read somebody else's cards than your own.
Oh, for sure. But I think the I Ching really comes in handy for that. Because I feel like with the I Ching, you can't change the meaning. It feels good. Like, as a diviner, I think the I Ching is a really powerful tool if you need your own divination that's also simultaneously, like, returned to the Tao and has, like, a sage aspect to it.
You know, I've not ever really looked into it. So you really heavily recommend it as a divination style?
Mm-hmm. I think historically, a lot of famous occultists at the end of their lives kind of said that was the one too. And I've heard a lot of people say that tarot readers say that they cannot read for themselves. I'm one of them. Depends on what the topic is. I obviously pull like for ritual and for self-exploration.
Yep.
But if I'm doing anything that's like about asserting my will and other people are involved, it gets murky. And then at that point I go to the I Ching, and the I Ching always says, you know, return to the Tao. And that's like, can be annoying, but it's always the best advice. And it will be very specific. You can get things from the I Ching about dates, seasons, places. It's not something that you can skirt around in the way that you can with the tarot, because like we're talking about, the paradox is such an essential aspect of the tarot that when you're in control, you can really confuse yourself and want it to mean something that it's not.
Well, yes, because I mean, and this is what I tell people when they sit down at my table at my day job in the French Quarter, because so a lot of people will like come in and they'll sit down and they think it's just some touristy thing and they want me to like prove that I can like predict their future like what they see in Hollywood. And I have to be like, no, that's not how this works. Like, how this is going to work is that I'm going to explain the archetype of the card, and then you're going to tell me how that applies to your life, you know? And from there, we can, like, say, okay, well, I see how these other cards, like, can apply to that. But, you know, it's a group activity. And in that way, it's kind of a Socratic discussion. Or even, like, you know, a psychoanalysis session, when it's like, how does me explaining this archetype to you make you feel?
Right. Exactly.
But doing that for yourself is like giving yourself therapy.
Yeah, that's the problem. I'm trying, obviously. But when you give yourself therapy, you end up in a neurotic spin out. And so we need each other, you know?
Yes.
We need someone else to point it out. The thing is that it's very hard and it's dangerous, because you cannot trust most people, and most people cannot trust themselves. And that's it, though. You know, fuck it. It's God. It's fun. We're out here. We out here doing scary shit. It's not all rainbows and, you know, whimsical Stevie Nicks twirling, even though I love Stevie Nicks. But I think there is something to be said about the path of the witch. I don't know if you identify as one, but I sure do and always have. And I think that there is like a malefic, painful, scary aspect to that path.
Certain things about being a witch. Yeah, it's like a witch's true initiation is trauma. And the witch's true identity is that of the other. And I think that's like an interesting thing about a culture, this like idea of like occult Twitter or whatever, that, or even just magical societies, is like this idea that the mystic and the witch, it's a solitary path. It's like, I've been thinking about this a lot lately. It's like Hecate, Queen of the Witches, is also lover of solitude. In the Andrew Chumbly Sabbatic Witchcraft Prayers, the Invocation of I, he says, a solitary and nomadic path am I. you know, sunlight to the prism of mind. It's like, I know that we, as humans, long for connection with the other. But the witch is something subhuman. The witch is the embodiment of the other, grappling at oppression and screaming for their right to power and their right to balance and their right to consume in a world that wants to subjugate them.
Yeah, hell yeah.
And through that, you know, I don't know that you can truly step into that role of like shape-shifting other bride of Satan, witch, if you are trying to be very engaged in the socio-public world of the internet. And I know, like, if we're trying to make a living out of it, we cannot completely leave it. But yeah. There, again, balance.
I've looked at the charts of some of the people that are doing that, and it seems like it's what they're supposed to do. And I think that that is because, not because they actually are end-all be-all authority on esoteric practice, because essentially esoteric means to look within. It's a solitary practice. Exoteric means go to someone else. So it is just in the word itself, it's a solitary practice, right? But as we shift things from being occulted to being more in the frontal part of our consciousness collectively, it's just part of it. It's going to be messy. And it's in that Horus kind of way where it's like, it's messy, right? They're saying that Eon is like pure violence and war. So in the same way you see within magical groups, there's a violent warring energy. And I think that's because they're manifesting that.
Yep.
You know? And I think that's just part of it.
Well, I literally could talk to you for another 2 hours.
People like actually can listen to this because I feel like it just sounds like a conversation between two people. And that is very much why I've always had a problem with interviews, because it goes from a conversation with two people to some kind of manifesto to the whole world, right? And it's so much harder in print. And I hope that whoever's listening to this gets something out of it. And if anything, just sees that there are other people like them that are not, you know, writing a book like, hey, I crossed the abyss, take my book. You know, it's like, I'm on the same path that probably a lot of the people listening to this are. And I want to contribute in a way consciously and try not, you know, do no harm on the way. And that is my personal challenge to myself, basically.
I think that's a beautiful challenge. I think that's a very admirable goal.
And it's not easy, and I will fail, you know, like there are people in the world I've hurt, and it's just, that's life. But every day we wake up and we have to address all of these things in a way where we forgive ourselves and we forgive others, because that is the like love is the law thing. You know, there's something about these divisions between us. We need those Saturnian boundaries, but they do cause suffering because they are a fantasy. They're a constructed fantasy, because there is no division between us. We are one cosmic being. And when we have those experiences outside of our own neurosis and complexes, like sexual experiences and love experiences, we know that to be true.
It's beautiful. Yeah. Yes.
Okay, I'm done.
Well, normally I do ask my guests if they have final words. Do you have final words?
If you have the energy for it, I did make a mix for the podcast, and I just wanted to maybe go over a couple of the songs and why I put them on there, and people can listen to the mix later.
Yeah, I'd love that.
Okay. So it was so interesting to me, because when I was doing it, you texted me like, have you ever done like Spotify, Stickomancy or whatever? And I was at the time, I feel like DJing is one of my most magical talents. And I do like kind of just channel it. And it always ends up telling some kind of story. I feel like songs are very much like tarot cards. They're like a window that you can kind of pathwork into, or some kind of understanding, Saturnian understanding, you know? So this is in the spirit of that, I just kind of like got into a gnosis zone and threw it together. But, okay, so I started the mix with The Seventh Seal by Scott Walker. And this mix is very much inspired for you and for this kind of Saturnian energy that we both have in our charts, and also that you've obviously dedicated your life's work to here, which I have such reverence and respect for. And this is kind of like a tribute to that. So The Seventh Seal, right? It's a song inspired by Bergman's movie of the same name.
I love that movie too.
To hear more on Tamarin's mix, please check out the Patreon at www.patreon.com/SaturnVox.